like sometimes a lot of the premiums have to do, you know.
I understand what you're saying, and I may actually agree with you in some cases. What I'm trying to do tonight is grow.
Yeah. Well, onward and upward, Robert.
Thank you, sir. Bye-bye. This is Earthwatch, and you are on the air. Hello.
Hi, Robert. How are you?
Good.
I just wanted to tell you, my friends from the Global Revolution live stream just got out of jail tonight. I don't know if you heard.
Global Revolution, that's part of the Occupy real-time notification video system, right?
Yes, it is. And I don't know if you know or not, but they were hit by a multi-agency task force a couple nights ago at their Bushwick Center. They declared the building was unsafe. They evicted them from the building. The next day, people went back into the building to try to get their things. They were arrested, and they just got out a few hours ago.
Well, I'm glad to hear that. I hope other producers. I'm about to be off the air in a few minutes. Tune in to 5 o'clock Shadow next week. We'll be on it
on Saturday at Bloomberg's Mansion. I mean, on Friday at Bloomberg's Mansion. Big protest Friday, 2 o'clock.
All right. Thank you.
It's about the arrest of journalists.
Yes, sir. Okay.
All right.
Understood. This is Earthwatch. We've got one. Let's see if we can get a half dozen calls done in half that many minutes. You're on the air.
Yes. Hey, Happy New Year, Robert.
Thank you.
The best to you in this coming year. I want to go catalytic, if I can.
All right. Rip it on me.
And I want to I just love that part of Zeitgeist. That breaks that down in terms of the mythology that is at our core. And I want to cite, are you familiar with Jordan Maxwell's work?
No, I'm not.
Well, go on the website, you know, just put in his name, and he has a lot of information, DVDs and CDs on astrotheology. That's one of his specialties. And he also breaks down the symbolism of the world.
Well, thank you for that. And
I also want to mention 16 Crucified Saviors by Graves and Gerald.
It's a start.
And Gerald Massey's work. And I'll listen. I guess you're going off soon.
Yeah,
I really
that's
love
right.
The program.
Well, I thank you, and I love you too. And great. See, my understanding of astrology and astronomy and celestial science and biomorphic cosmology is so that we can, in the highest way, know our place. You're on the air.
Hello there, Robin. How you doing?
Good.
Stevie, I just want to make a quick statement that along with the, I want to talk about the astrology for a moment. I have found that a lot of times people say, oh, man will never understand women. And I have found that if you treat a woman as to her astrological sign, you will get along with her famously. So.
Okay, thank you for that. Well, you know what? There's a line I love from Married with Children where Kelly Bundy says, I'm everybody's type. This is Earthwatch, and you're on the air.
Yes, it's Tom from the Bronx.
Hey, here. Tom, you got 20 seconds.
Yeah, I'd like to say that did you know that there's an ironwood tree that actually has iron in the bark, and there's the plant that has oil, and I believe that all of this is a throw-off, like, from the molten lava.
Well, it's true. Plants become oil. And finally.
Hey, Robert?
Yes.
Yeah, thanks to the Gil Scott here. Yeah, the Zeitgeist, the movie has some interesting stuff in it, but it also has a lot of red flaggy stuff.
You see, I haven't gotten that far. All I have ever heard of it is only what you heard on tonight's show.
Like David Icke, who's the anti-Semitist from England.
Gotcha. Understood. I'm not down with anti-inism. I found the part that I was specifically and exclusively pointed to intriguing and consistent with prior studies of mine. Huh?
Yeah, I find the astrotheology to be very reductionist. It's just not a good... It has a grain of truth in it, but it's not a good explanation of the world's religion.
Well, you see, but you're forgetting what I said at the beginning of the program, which is that the exploration of these mythologies is not a predictive assertion, but an interpretive one. And I further contained it to being limited to the local mythologies, and by no means presume that it is a global constant. My point and goal is to give stimulus to thought so that one might achieve escape velocity. There is a truism in logic that you can reach a true conclusion from both a true and a false premise if you follow the rules of logic. You cannot go from a true premise to a false conclusion like the Tea Party. And my goal was to offer food for thought. And my concluding thought is, and thank you all for calling and for the variety of discussion. I really do appreciate that. And how could I... Well, let's see. First, I'd love to hear from you. Please communicate to Robert Knight, R-K-N-I-G-H-T, R Knight with a K, at WBAI.org. And just before we go to Hour of the Wolf with Jim Freund, how could I conclude a show on equinoctial precession of the ages and solar mythology without including the original sun ray of the music we know and love, Sun Ray, Sun Ra?
The world is waiting for the sunlight.
This is WBAI coming up right after this. Jim Freund with Hour of the Wolf. Thank you for listening to Earthwatch.
For the sunlight, for the sunlight. The world is waiting for the sunlight, for the sunlight.
Some call me Mr. Ra. Others call me Mystery. You can call me Mr. Mystery.
Good morning. This is Hour of the Wolf, a program dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, enchantment, and yes, the imagination. My name is Jim Freund. This morning, subversion I mean, yeah, it's WBAI, so it's always about subversion, but this morning it's about, well, a book by that name. Stay tuned. And good morning. As I was just telling Robert, the wonderful thing about having had that wolf opening is you can segue, if you do it right, you can segue it with almost anything. And when you are broadcasting at this time of night, morning thing that it is, segues are what it's about. It really, really is. This is WBAI in New York City. Listener-sponsored, non-commercial Pacifica Radio, 99.5 FM. And we have some fun shows coming up for you this month. Coming up next week, we will have approximately 12 guests. I kid you not. This will be something we haven't done in a while. Now, some of it is pre-recorded and some of it will be live. So not all 12 guests will be in the studio. But the guests are Altered Fluid. That is a writer's group, basically people who workshop their stuff every week. They meet and critique people's work. And what we will have is one of the writers in that group, Devin Poor, who will be here live. He will read this short story. And then 3 months ago, I recorded the group's reaction to the story. Some members of the group will be here next week, some not. It's not easy for them all. On Saturday mornings, when we had 2 hours, we used to do it, the whole thing live. But, well, this is a different form. We're trying it differently. So that will be a lot of fun. The story is really good. And the process of listening to people dissect a first draft is very interesting. And because we recorded it, because we did it in that manner, Devin, the writer, Devin Poor, has already made certain changes to the story in reaction to what people said about it, and so we will actually get to see the before and after. So that's the 11th. The 18th. Not much. The 40th anniversary of this program. Okay. I don't know exactly when Hour of the Wolf began. It was 1972, and between Margot Adler and I, we think it was January. The first evidence we have of its existing was in March 72, when it was in the WBAI folio. But the folio, Hour of the Wolf is what turned BAI into a 24-hour station. And so, for a while, it wasn't listed as an official program. We had Radio Unnameable, which went in those days till whenever, sometime after 3. Sometimes Bob Fass would go off at, 3:15. Sometimes he would go off at 6. It was within the discretion of the freeform spirit, a form that Bob basically, I don't know if he invented it, but he made it what it is. He honed it. And without him and without that, well, it just wouldn't exist today, really. Not in the manner in which it does. And it never has existed the way he does. It's a wonderful thing. So when Margot started Hour of the Wolf, we became a 24-hour-a-day radio station, because what she did was she said, give me airtime, in that interstitial moment before Josephson came on at 7 a.m. within the beginning and after sign-off. So it wasn't in the folio for a while. But my recollection is by the time it was in the folio, and Hour of the Wolf, by the way, was 5 days a week then, 5 to 7 a.m., because Adler was fabulous and she could do it. And I was her co-host Thursdays and Fridays. Mondays, she would often have another co-host, sometimes Mike Odell, sometimes Neil Conan. She had different people come in often on Mondays. But I was the Thursday and Friday co-host. And the rest of the time, it was just Marco. So I have anointed January 18th to be the celebration of 40 years of Hour of the Wolf, although we do not know the exact date. It's close enough for radio, as we say here. And Robert Knight has very graciously donated Earthwatch for that morning so that we can do a 3-hour program, and I won't host it. Our host will be Margot Adler, as befitting the concept of a celebration. Margot and I actually did a last Hour of the Wolf, and Hour of the Wolf was canceled, basically, by about a year and 2 months ago. And then finally I was wedged in here, and I still call the show Hour of the Wolf, even though it isn't the Hour of the Wolf, but because, well, it's branded, okay? When I took over the show in 74, I sort of feel, okay, I haven't been doing it 40 years. I've only been the host 38 years, although I was Margot's co-host for some episodes those first years. So I've sort of, like, kept that name, and even if it were the middle of the afternoon, I would keep that name. But Margot will be here on the 18th. On the 25th, I have a conflict, okay? I believe our guest will be Delia Sherman, the wonderful Delia Sherman. But I had a prior commitment to Mike Cole. This would normally not be a problem, except for the fact that the following week we go into fundraising drive, and so I will be missing the 5 shows after that in terms of normal whatever. So we will figure out exactly how that will work out. But one way or the other, whether it's Delia, Mike, Altered Fluid next week, or the 40th anniversary of Hour of the Wolf the week after, we have a fun January for you, and I hope that you will tune in. And again, a special thanks goes to Robert Knight for facilitating a 3-hour broadcast for this morning. Okay, last week you heard me mention that the New York Review of Science Fiction reading series, which is something that I produce and curate, was having an event last night. And it's all based on this book called Subversion. Now, I'm not sure if it's the first anthology publication outside of Cross Genres Press, but Cross Genres is moving over from being a magazine to becoming a publisher. And the editor, well, he will explain that for you very shortly, because we're going to hear, well, a fudging of it. We had 3 readers last night, and a fun time was had by all. And the readers were Barbara Krasnoff, K.T. T. Holt, and it's not Katie, it's K and then middle initial T, Holt, H-O-L-T, and then Daniel Jose Older. And three really cool performances. And Daniel is a performance artist himself. He does blues and hip-hop and various things. So his reading style about a fellow who was supposed to have been zombified, but they didn't quite make it, just brilliant and funny. And Kay's story about some kids who get a hacker to change their parents. But Barbara's story from that collection, The Red Dybbuk, she did not perform because she had read that last April when she performed with Lev Grossman. Somebody's supposed to be coming up on this show. I should have had him on before now, and this is just, you know, my own because his second book, the second fiction book, The Magician Kings, is out and getting rave reviews and all that. And so anyway, Lev and Barbara read, and Barbara read this story from this yet untitled anthology. So she didn't want to read that last night because this is that anthology. She read another piece called Rosemary, That's for Remembrance. So what we're going to do is we're going to play a switch. We're going to have Bart introduce the reading from last night and talk about crossed genres, his press. Katie Holt is his wife, and they are crossed genres together. And then he would be introducing Barbara reading Rosemary, That's for Remembrance. But aha, we pull a switch. We will then have Barbara reading the story from the book Subversion, Science Fiction and Fantasy Tales That Challenge the Norm. And so we will hear the introduction to something that is not in the book, and then we will hear a story that, in fact, is in the book. So you're going to need to set your Wayback Machine for two settings. One for yesterday evening at about 7:15, where I will introduce Bart Lieb and he will introduce Barbara Krasnoff. And then we're going to go to a bit of a time jump and have Barbara Krasnoff reading from April 5th, 2011. So, without any further ado, here's me. Bart Lieb is the co-publisher of Cross-Genre Publications. He has edited the anthology, Subversion, Science Fiction, and Fantasy Tales of Challenging the Norm, and has co-edited Fat Girl in a Strange Land, which will be coming out February 17th. Bart's fiction has been published in M-Brain, that's M-B-R-A-N-E, SF Magazine, and the anthology Beauty Has Her Way. His nonfiction has been published by Fantasy Magazine and Science in My Fiction. He lives in Massachusetts with his wife, Kay, their son, Bastion, and two cats. At any given moment, he is more active project than he has fingers. I'm not going near that. He can be found online at subvertthespace.com/Bart Lieb. That's L-E-I-B. I screwed that up once and I on a flyer, and I'm still totally embarrassed about that. He's also on Twitter as Metafrantic. That one is easy to spell. So with that, let me introduce Bart Lieb.
Hello, thank you. I guess I'm here to introduce Cross-Genres and the anthology. Cross-Genres began about 3 years ago solely as a magazine, Cross-Genres Magazine, which we just recently retired. Cross-Genres published its 36th and final issue last month, and we just 2 days ago published the last print quarterly. Cross-Genres had been shifting very gradually, but inevitably towards publishing just books, novels, and anthologies. And we finally decided that it was time to make the change complete and permanent. We have published a couple of novels, a couple of anthologies, obviously, as you will see tonight. Subversion was the first to come out after that change. It just came out on December 5th. Subversion came from the idea that I personally am in favor of seeing the norm subverted, but I don't like to see the stereotypical and well-known use of the term. That usually involves violence. A lot of people have this idea that subversion has to involve explosions and destroying of infrastructure, and I'm much more in favor of the little personal subversions that we all think about doing every day and sometimes even let ourselves get away with. That was what the focus was when we published Subversion, and the stories, I think, reflect that. The reviews have definitely reflected that in that they have all said that the stories were much subtler than they expected them to be, which I take to mean, where were all the explosions? however, mostly the response has been very positive to this, which I'm pleased with, because I believe it's much easier to relate to a very personal act of subversion and to understand the motivations behind it than it is to relate to something much more violent. So I don't want to talk very much because I know you're here to hear the reading, so I'm going to introduce the first reader. Barbara Krasnoff is a Brooklyn native. She divides her time between writing speculative fiction and working as features and reviews editor at Computer World. Her short stories have appeared in many places: Sybil's Garage, Lady Churchill's Rosebud Wristlet, Space and Time Magazine, Electric Velocipede, to name just a few. She has a story in our upcoming anthology, Fat Girl in a Strange Land, which Jim mentioned is coming out in February. And she is a member of the New York City writers group Tabula Rasa. And she will be reading, she's not going to be reading from her story from this anthology because she read it here a few months ago.
Which is what we'll hear.
Additional story. Please welcome Barbara Krasnoff.
Fade out, reset time machine to last April, and fade in.
What, it isn't intermission already? Okay, the Red Dybbuk is a story that I wrote based on some family history, which will become obvious. And it has been sold to an anthology called Subversion. For reasons which will also become obvious. Red Dybbuk. Marilyn wanders among the tombstones. The Long Island Cemetery, a place for the Jewish dead for generations, is crowded with graves. Appropriate, she thinks, for those who live their lives crowded in the cities. The grounds are so vast that guests come with maps in hand. Most drive to a specific section, park halfway on the grass, trying not to violate one of the graves, and make their obligatory visit, leaving small stones as markers of their presence. But Marilyn doesn't need a map. After losing both grandparents and a father, she usually parks at the cemetery's main gates and strolls to the section where her family lies. It's not hard to miss. Marilyn knows she's come to the right place when she spots, high against the early afternoon clouds, a statue of a woman in coveralls, fist thrust to the sky. She continues slowly, unhurried, careful to avoid a small funeral some yards away, where about 15 people stand and chant Kaddish. Otherwise, on this weekday afternoon, she is alone. She walks through the small, rusty gate that marks the beginning of the section, other areas were sponsored by synagogues or organizations based around whatever Eastern European town the family escaped from. One of the first tasks on any immigrant Jew's list was to make sure they had somewhere respectable to bury their dead. But this piece of land was bought by a union of fur workers. The union was eventually purged of its radicalism during the 1950s, when union officials began to court respectability and avoid the taint of left-wing radicalism. But the graves and the memories they evoke remain. She runs her hands along slowly fading carvings of Jewish stars, upraised hands, and hammers and sickles, and haltingly reads Yiddish poems by long-dead writers foretelling the triumph of the working class. Finally, she stops by a modest black stone that has no verse or statue, but just two names, two dates, and two small oval black and white photos. A round-faced young woman and a thin man with a mustache stare solemnly out at a long-dead photographer. "Grandma," she says to the woman, and then, in halting Yiddish, "Bube, what have you done to our baby?" I know you're not going to like this, but I'm leaving college. Marilyn stopped chopping celery and stared at her daughter. "Keep calm," she told herself. "You knew something was coming. She's 18. She's the age at which she's going to make you insane." "May I ask why?" Marilyn said, trying to keep her tone even. Annie, her baby, her only child from a marriage that faded long ago, was still not fully grown in Marilyn's eyes, but all long legs and thin arms and short flyaway hair. The girl reached out and took a piece of celery in an obvious attempt to be casual, but Marilyn could see her hand was trembling slightly. "Well, last weekend I went to great-grandma's grave. You remember you told me that I should go there to see some family history? And I saw all the graves of the people who spent their lives fighting for what they believed in, and I became ashamed of how I was wasting my life. I'm going to live here for a while, take some courses in Somali and French, maybe in farming or first aid. Aid, refugees are starving while we play student and teacher. I can't sit by while that happens." "I see." Marilyn put down the knife, not only so she could give her daughter her full attention, but because she suspected it was not the best time to have a knife in her hand. "And what brought this on?" Annie shrugged. "I just realized that I was wasting my life sitting around in classrooms listening to a bunch of overpaid bourgeois tutors tell me how to spend my life as a willing victim of American consumerism." Since Annie had, until recently, been a very willing consumer of media players, computer games, expensive shoes, and the occasional tattoo, Marilyn was a bit worried. Also, since when was her daughter using words like bourgeois? She placed a solicitous hand against the girl's forehead. "Are you feeling well?" she asked. "Are you running a temperature?" Annie pulled away irritably. "I'm fine," she said. "Really, Mom?" And she flounced off, taking a loud bite out of the celery stalk. "She's going through a phase," said Marilyn's best friend Sandy when they met at the Ginger Cafe the next Sunday. "It could be worse. She could have found religion and ended up sleeping with some middle-aged guru out in Oklahoma like Sarah's daughter." "Bite your tongue," Marilyn said, shocked and appalled. "My baby wouldn't do something like that. Your baby is a human American girl, and so is going to do at least one or two crazy things before she settles down and becomes a boring adult," said Sandy. "If what she does is get a political conscience and perform a few good deeds, all to the better." Marilyn, whose mother had lost her teaching job during the McCarthy era, and who, as a result, could never rid herself of a sneaking fear of doing anything that might place her name in a file somewhere, just nodded and mentally crossed her fingers. Hopefully, the phase was indeed a phase and would be over before Annie could get herself in trouble or actually leave college. Marilyn sits cross-legged in the narrow grassy lane in front of the grave, shrugs off her backpack, reaches in, and pulls out an old, perilously yellowing album. She places it on her lap and opens it to the first photo. Three children stand stiffly in uncomfortable poses, carefully groomed for what must have been a special occasion for turn-of-the-20th-century youngsters. "You want a prayer?" She looks up. An elderly man in a worn, faded suit, a small yarmulke askew on his balding head, stares at her disapprovingly. "You want a Kaddish?" "Of course," she thinks. As a woman, she can't say Kaddish. For a small fee, this man will say it for her. She is tempted for a moment. What could it hurt? But thinks then of what her grandmother would say. "No, thank you," she replies, putting a slight edge in her voice to warn him not to press his case. He shrugs eloquently and moves on. Marilyn looks back at the photo. A 10-year-old boy in short pants and cap carefully holds the hand of his sister, 8 years old, and already showing the stubborn press of lips that, Marilyn remembers, lasted into old age. The girl, in turn, clutches the hand of her younger brother, a toddler with long curls and a sweet smile. All gone now. They, and most of their children. Marilyn puts out a finger and lightly touches the head of the little girl, who glares back defiantly. The police station was a lot less frightening than Marilyn had imagined it to be, although it was just as seedy. The lawyer hired by the organization for which Annie had been demonstrating seemed to be a nice young man. Marilyn took his card and made a mental note to call her own lawyer when she got home. It only took about 15 or 20 minutes for Annie, pale but determined, to emerge from a far door and walk over to her mother. A bored sergeant gave Marilyn a receipt for the bail. "Make sure she shows up for the hearing," he said, staring with tired disapproval at his pen, which seemed to be misbehaving. "And don't worry about it. The judge will most likely just throw a fine at them and lecture them for a few minutes, depending on how busy he is. Here's your receipt. Next." It wasn't until they were in the car, and at least a mile from the police station, that Marilyn felt secure enough to say, "For God's sake, whatever possessed you to confront those protesters?" Annie stared ahead stubbornly, with a new set to her shoulders that Marilyn found weirdly familiar. "Prejudice against any group is prejudice against us all. Those small-minded bigots claim to be against terrorism, but they are using a tragedy as an excuse to terrorize those in our society who don't conform to their narrow definition of what is American. Why don't you just start a Facebook group? Or send some emails to your representative, or do something digital?" asked Marilyn wearily. "Why did you have to start tearing up their signs? Didn't you think that somebody might try to stop you? Like, say, the police?" Her daughter shrugged and continued to look out at the road in front of them. There was a haunted look in her eyes that made Marilyn's stomach clench. "Honey," she said, trying to keep her voice even, "are you all right? Did anything happen in that jail that you need to tell me about?" "I'm fine," Annie said. "Just fine. Everybody was very polite. Except for one miserable son of a bitch who felt it necessary to push one of our group, Sophia. So she fell and skinned her knee. Of course he chose the black woman to pick on, the goddamn racist schmuck. A fire Zolim Treffen." Marilyn swerved the car into the other lane and almost clipped an SUV, whose driver cursed her silently behind his windows. She took a breath, kept her eyes on the road, and said steadily, "Honey, where did you learn that phrase?" "What phrase?" "The one you just used, a fire soll ihm treffen. It means a fire should burn him." Where did you learn that? Annie closed her eyes. I don't know what you're talking about. I'm tired, Mom. I'm going to take a nap, if you don't mind. We can do the whole mother-daughter, you're in trouble thing later, okay? That evening, Marilyn sat on her front porch and stared out onto the yard, where a few of the first fireflies of the season were trying out their neon. The sound of her very American daughter cursing out the police in Yiddish kept running through her brain. Then something occurred to her. I suppose it's possible, she told the insects. She pulled out her mobile phone. Mom, she said when it was picked up on the other end, can I ask you something? There was a pause. What's wrong? Nothing's wrong, Mom. I just wanted to ask you, when you were babysitting Annie, when she was small, how much Yiddish did you use with her? What's wrong with Annie? Is she all right? She's fine. I'm fine. We're all fine. But she used a Yiddish expression today that I'd never heard her use, and I was wondering, did you ever use the expression a feierzolem treffen in front of her? There was a short, obviously offended silence. Of course not. You know I'd never curse in front of a child. Your grandmother, may she rest in peace, used that expression a lot, especially when she was talking about her enemies. And she had a lot of enemies. But she died before Annie was born, didn't she? A pause. Her mother's memory wasn't what it used to be these days. Of course she did. Annie was named after her. How could I forget something like that? And she has your grandmother's eyes. The next album has photos of Marilyn's mother, a teenager in calf-length dresses and high heels, dark lips that would have been bright red if the photos had been in color, grinning at long-dead young men in jaunty World War II uniforms. Marilyn turns to the last page, her mother's mother, now middle-aged, hands thrust into the pockets of a long fur coat as if to keep them still. There is a look of grim satisfaction on her face. She is obviously determined to enjoy the moment if it kills her. You loved that fur coat, didn't you, Bubba? Marilyn says out loud. You always said that Grandpa had ruined his hands curing furs for rich women to wear, and you were determined that at least one of those coats would end up on the back of somebody who actually deserved one. And then you gave it to me, your beloved granddaughter, and I refused to wear it because it was seal, and they were clubbing seals in the Antarctic. Cause versus cause. And who wins in the end? Living and dead smile at one another. Marilyn had finally gotten around to reading this week's New York Times Magazine section, one eye on the umpteenth rerun of Casablanca on cable, when the front door opened. Annie, is that you? She called out. Did you remember to pick up the milk I asked you to get? There was no answer, just some footsteps in the direction of the bathroom. Marilyn stood. You forgot, didn't you? Was it that hard just to write down? And she stopped short at the bathroom door. Annie was sitting on the closed toilet seat, a bloody washcloth pressed to her temple. There was dried blood under her nose and around her mouth, a cut on the bridge of her nose, and scrapes all along the side of her face and left arm. She was a mess. Oh, my God! Marilyn ran over and pulled the washcloth from her daughter's head. The cut was long and ugly-looking, but didn't look very deep. Marilyn opened the bathroom closet, grabbed a roll of gauze, dampened a piece, and began to carefully clean off her daughter's face. Honey, what happened? Are you dizzy? Are you feeling sick? I think we'd better get you to the hospital. I'm fine, Mom, said Annie wearily. Really, we were just trying to keep some squatters from being evicted from an abandoned building, and we thought the man who owned it would at most call the cops, but instead these three thugs, these stalkers, came and threw us out, and I fell down the stairs. She started to cry quietly. Marilyn didn't bother with any more details. She got her pocketbook and her coat, guided her daughter to the car, there was no resistance, and took her to the emergency room. She told the receptionist and the doctors that Annie had been in the city and tripped at the top of some steps and was brought home by friends, all of which was true, in a sense. Annie needed a couple of stitches in her head, and there was a chance her nose might be broken. "Let the swelling go down," the doctor said, obviously not at all interested in what to him was a minor case, "and then go see your regular doctor." But that was all. They got back around 1 a.m. The entire time, sitting in the waiting room, in the examination room, in X-ray, Marilyn just talked about everyday things, calling Annie's friends to tell them she'd be staying home for the next couple of days, whether Annie could still go on a march she had planned to attend in D.C. that weekend, Marilyn's plans to visit a cousin the following month. Only once, when they were driving back from the hospital, did Marilyn venture a question. "Baby," she asked, "why did you go there? Didn't you realize what kind of people you were dealing with?" Annie took a deep breath, and for the first time that evening, there was a tremor in her voice. "I don't know, Mom," she said. I don't know. It's just that I have to help. I have to do these things. Then suddenly, she lifted her head and looked directly at her mother. "Somebody has to relieve the miseries that are inflicted on them by the ruling classes," she said, clearly and steadily. "If your generation chooses to ignore these ills, then it is up to mine. If your values don't include working for change and for the betterment of humanity, then mine do." Marilyn stared at her daughter. The girl's voice had acquired the Russian Jewish lilt that Marilyn remembered from her childhood, the same intonations that her grandmother had used all her life. The last album is Marilyn's, from her childhood and young adulthood. She pages through well-remembered photos. A tiny version of her brother, now a pudgy executive with three kids and a third wife, grins at the camera. Her father sits in their living room playing Woody Guthrie tunes on an acoustic guitar to a crowd of fascinated children. Long-haired college kids dance enthusiastically in Washington Square Park. And a stocky woman in her 60s, with white hair, stands in a queue of older folks and students and grins sardonically at the camera. "That was the afternoon I took you to see that Yiddish film," Marilyn tells her grandmother. "The Divik, from the Anski play. I'm sure you must remember it. About the poor yeshiva bocher, the student, who is not permitted to marry the girl he has promised to because of the greed of her parents, and who dies, and then inhabits the body of his beloved. It is a fable, you said, of how money corrupts the older generation, and how only the dedication and passion of the younger generation can overcome their greed." She drops the folder, kneels, and puts her hand against a stone. "But Bube, when the scholar Hanun inhabits the body of Leah, it is with her consent, and it is two young people coming together after they have been told they can't marry. You are of another generation, another world, and you can't know what it's like for the children of Annie's generation." Leaves crunch behind her, and Marilyn looks up, embarrassed to be caught by some stranger. But it's Annie, standing tall and angry amid the tombstones and the dead. Marilyn quickly stands. "Honey, I told you to pick me up around 5 p.m. It can't be that late yet." "Is the fight all that different, even today?" Annie asks in quick, unaccented Yiddish. "Or has it simply been twisted by men in power who have used their money and influence to make socialism a curse word, to make cooperation and consensus a thing of the past, to make each worker a pawn in every government's fight to stay in power? Look around you. Are people not losing their jobs? Not being driven from their homes? How many people around the world have become simply statistics, irrelevant except as weapons in the wars of those who consider themselves better?" Marilyn answers in English, in the language she knows best. She needs to be fluent. She is fighting for her daughter. No, of course not, she says. Things are as bad as they were, if not worse. But do you really know what is important in this world? In your day, it was the bosses and the birth of the unions. In my mother's, it was civil rights and red baiting. In mine, it was Vietnam. And what is it in Annie's? Global warming? The Middle East? Gay rights? Or are you going to drag her into causes that she wouldn't have followed herself simply because they are your causes? Marilyn finds herself starting to cry and bangs her fist on her thigh, trying to keep her composure. Bubba, you had your life. You fought the good fight. You joined with your comrades to keep the bosses and the police and the politicians at bay. You kept the unions going. You pulled your family through the Depression. You helped women get birth control. But your fight isn't her fight. It is all the same fight. Is it? And even if some of the battles are the same, is she ready for it? Before you appeared, my daughter was in college studying, preparing herself for whatever her life will be. Who knows what she may be able to do years from now? Maybe she'll become a doctor or a lawyer or an activist. Maybe she'll create websites or work with technologies that we can't even imagine. Or maybe she'll choose to work quietly and raise children and have a happy, safe life. Why would you deny her that? Is she worth any less than any of the people you fought for? Silence. Leave her. Now. I can't. Annie, both and one, cries out in pain and sorrow. I need to work. I can't just rest and let the world go on the way it does. It is a sort of a hell. And when my great-granddaughter, the darling, the jewel, came one day to visit me and talk to me, what else could I do? She welcomed me, and I came. What else could I do? Marilyn takes another step, until she is close enough to reach out and touch her daughter's, her grandmother's, cheek. Leave her, Bubba. Let her make her own life. She pauses for a moment. Take mine. Annie steps back. Mirilla, what are you saying? Are you sure? Yes, I am. Marilyn turns and looks out over the cemetery. When I grew up, I knew what had happened to you, to my mother. I wanted to live a safe life. I got a safe job, married a safe man, divorced him in a safe manner, lived in a safe neighborhood, and brought up a lovely, safe child. Now she's ready to go off on her own, and what do I have? My daughter is leaving, my husband is gone. Life is starting to run short, and I haven't done anything significant on my own. Something so people will say, look at what she did, how she helped. I want that. I want to make a difference. And if I can't do it on my own, I'll do it with you. She stretches out her arms. Take me, Bubba. Live with me in my skin. We'll go out and together we'll challenge the evil that still stalks our world. You'll teach me how to fight, and I'll teach you how to live. Marilyn suddenly wants to laugh, as though she's found something she didn't know she'd lost. The bastards won't know what hit 'em. There is a moment in which everything is still. And then her daughter, her grandmother, smiles, a lovely, joyous smile. Come, my sweet child, she sings. Come, my angel, my little bird, my Mirilla. Let us change the world together.
Come all you good workers. good news to you, I'll tell of how the good old Union has come in here to dwell.
Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
You've been listening to Red Dybbuk, read by the author Barbara Krasnoff, from the anthology Subversion, edited by Bart R. Lieb. This is Natalie Merchant.
And there he was, a miner. He's now in the end, son. Be with you, fellow workers, until the battle's won. Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on? Which side are you on, boys? Which side are you on?
You're tuned to listener-sponsored non-commercial Pacifica Radio, New York City, WBAI, broadcasting at 99.5 FM. And as mentioned, that was Natalie Merchant with one of the best versions of Which Side Are You On? I mean, it's a great song to begin with, but somehow she gives that... I don't know. She gives me chills when I hear her do certain songs, and that is certainly one of them. And an appropriate song to follow the story, The Red Dybbuk, or Red Dybbuk, I'm never sure which it is, by Barbara Krasnoff, K-R-A-S-N-O-F-F, as read at the New York Review of Science Fiction Readings last April, where she co-read with Lev Grossman, who I've got to get, I have a promise to him, and he has a promise to me to be on the show soon. And we need to make that happen. The second book in his series, The Magician King, is just out now. Came out for the holiday season. And last night we held a reading of two and a half stories out of the anthology Subversion, Science Fiction and Fantasy Tales That Challenge the Norm. And that story is from that collection, as were two other stories that were read last night. And we had a wonderful time. And if you're interested in the book, well, go to your preferred bookseller. Or you can look up the publisher, buy it from them directly, Crossed Genre Press. That's C-R-O-S-S-E-D, Crossed Genre, G-E-N-R-E. I think it's S. I think it's, let me... take a look here. Yes, Cross Genres Press. Google those up and you will find different places where you can purchase the books. Actually, it's Cross Genres Publication, but that won't be a problem. And I see that it's available at online bookstores and possibly it should be in a few brick and mortar stores, as they like to say, and apparently also in electronic format. So it's a trade paperback, so not expensive. So let's see. I do not have a specific agenda for the rest of this program. I am still annoyed / mourning the death of two people in the WBAI family, Lynn Samuels and Monroe Lippman. And I'm also willing to talk about that on the air with you, and also to take phone calls about the genre of science fiction and fantasy in general. The telephone number here at WBAI is 212-209-2900. Again, 212-209-2900. And, the rules are the usual rules. Be on topic, or, like Monroe Lippman, be cut off. Although I'd let him speak occasionally, he was brilliant. Good morning, you're on the radio.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I've got a question.
Yeah.
You mentioned that Monroe Lippman was a graphic artist, and he did movie posters, science fiction specifically.
Well, not specifically science fiction. Among movie posters that he did and designs that he did, there were some science fiction films.
Yeah, I had a burning question to ask you. Any films that I might recognize?
Yes, but I can't name them. I think he may have done Alien, the first Alien, but I'm not sure.
Oh.
Unfortunately, I can no longer ask, but it seems to me many, many years ago he mentioned that.
Okay, great. And my second question, how do you say he should burn in Yiddish?
Don't ask me, ask Barbara Krasnoff. I do not know Yiddish. I do not know German. I know my own last name in German. That's about it.
Okay.
I'm afraid I never learned any of it.
I really enjoyed that story. So thank you for sharing it with us.
Thank you for listening.
Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. And good morning, you're on the radio.
Jim.
Yes.
You making me cry. That story was so what I needed tonight. And I keep thinking of Monroe. I miss him so badly. Because towards the end, he kept telling me, I got to see you now. Can't you come? Can I come to your place? And I just was like you, I guess, like a lot of us, I would find reasons why it wouldn't be possible. And now it's not possible. So thank heavens you're the only person, plus the music that Night Shift did, I thought was very beautiful. But you always have said the truth about, I've never known you to not be honest, and that's what I find so admirable.
Well, I tell my truth, as it were.
That's what I meant.
Well, yeah, it's not necessarily, you know, it's all...
No, honest to yourself. It may not be someone else's truth. I mean that you try to be true to yourself. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does.
Well, what I meant was, I found him so incredibly chivalrous, and so we argued so terribly the way you did. We would have fisticuffs because I was terrible. And my family thinks I'm terrible when I'm so adamant. And I realize now, I wish I had shut my mouth and just listened more.
Well, yeah, but, the problem, there was stuff to listen to, but the problem was always getting him on topic and getting him off his obsessions.
And you know what that was? I think he wanted to finish his work. He had a lot of books he was trying to get in order, and he did make a film. Hutchison, is that the guy's name that did the film? He wanted to finish that film, so I'm hoping that some of his books and some of the things he wanted to go to certain, he didn't want them thrown out because he was a great collector. And he did mail me some of the things that he, in his childhood, we don't have to go into this now, but he wanted me to go on the internet and see this before he passed. So I'm thinking the work will still be there, and I know what he mailed me, but he did want me to see that film. So I hope someday we can know more about him, because as I told you, I know more about you and your program than I did about Monroe's work. I only got to know it in the last month now, a year or two, when we didn't see each other so much. And I just think, how is the word? That story you said, you miss, what's her name, Krasnov. That story is just about what I consider my whole life, the best people in my life that I've always loved were like that. The grandmother would have one opinion, the other one the other, and yet they loved each other, even if they disagreed. And I love Yiddish. My family thinks I'm crazy. I used to take my kids.
Well, maybe you can answer the previous caller's question.
I didn't hear it exactly. What did he ask?
I think it was, may you burn or something.
Oh, I couldn't quite say that phrase because I didn't hear it, but it makes a lot of sense because I've spoken to many people that, I've gone to Yiddish plays, so I may not know that particular phrase, but the good thing I like about the wisdom of Yiddish is they never lie about when you're angry, you shouldn't hide it. You should.
Oh, God, no. Yeah, very interesting, by the way, is that about a week ago, Barbara Krasnov found photographs of the people that helped inspire the story, some of the union workers, the furriers, and all that. Photos from the 1920s when the unions were evolving. So there are now photographs to go along with that story.
And not only that, wait till we see some of his work, because he said he has...
Well, I'm talking about Barbara's.
No, I know, because I had a grandfather that was...
The people that inspired that story.
Well, I think that's very important. I want to see that. But what I'm also saying is people still kill animals brutally, and I think it's wrong. But what are you going to do? The people, we still have a lot of brute. That's why her story was so, I couldn't tell you. That was just what I needed to hear tonight.
Okay, I'm pleased that you enjoyed it.
Well, I know more about Yiddish than Monroe did.
Well, there you go, and certainly more than I.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Have a great morning. Okay. And good morning, WBAI. You're on the air.
Good morning.
Good morning, Robert.
Happy New Year. I wish I could say it to you in German. And I actually knew how to say Happy New Year.
Well, it wouldn't mean anything to me if you said it in German,
well,
you know.
No,
my
no.
parents were German. I'm first generation American.
No, I only mention it because when we did our German rebels last year, we had to yell Happy New Year in German. Anyway, I don't know what to say after a story like that. I don't know which was better, the story which hit like an earthquake and got better, or your segue into Natalie Merchant. And I have to tell you, she gives me the same chills as Lorena McKennitt, but for the same reason. I mean, when I hear her, Lorena McKennitt, do The Highwaymen.
Yeah, that's exactly the song I was thinking of.
Yes, yes, yes. And
there's something about the lyrical sound, the way they each approach those songs.
Well, one of the reasons that both interest me, I love tunes and songs in a minor key. I'm sorry, that's my musical thing. I love minor. And, of course, Natalie does it, obviously, that's in a minor key. But Lorena's version of The Highwaymen, of course, is a very haunting melody.
Yeah, it's beautifully done. Although she uses, I've caught her, you know, listening, because sometimes I'll spend an entire day just listening to Lorena McKennitt.
Uh-huh.
There are worse ways to spend a day.
Yeah, yes.
And I've caught her. She uses that same melody more than once.
Really?
Yeah.
Not on the same CD, though, right?
Yes, sometimes
on
the same CD. On the Mummer's Dance, she will use like a melody here and there. She, you know, but you know, think of it as a leitmotif.
No,
I mean,
no.
God's sake, Mozart used the same melody frequently.
So
if Mozart could do it, good enough for Lorena McKennitt.
I have to say, I would have been there last night, but I was winging my way across the big pond from ye olde England, and I actually heard about Lynn's passing in England, and I was very sorry. She was very snipshous. That's an old Southern word for persnickety and whatever person, and she rubbed, you know, she got a lot of people angry, but
from Southern, I assume you mean Queens.
No, Southern U.S.
Never mind.
No, that's okay. I have to say that if all the stories in Subversion are like Barbara's, this is kind
of it's a pretty good collection.
And the one about, what would you say, there was one about a zombie that didn't quite get there or something?
Yeah.
Yeah.
In Brooklyn, yes.
And, yeah.
By Daniel Jose Older,
yeah,
yes.
And the one about the kids who hacked into their parents or something. That sounds interesting.
Well, you missed the reading last night. What can I say?
What can I tell you? You can't be on a plane as well. And your 40th anniversary should be fun. What are you doing February for the reading? Nurses.
That will be Coast Guard.
Oh, Coast Guard, yes. Not pirates, Coast Guard.
Right.
Okay. All right, well, again, Happy New Year, and tell Barbara that she is, as the ancient Finns used to say, a wordsmith, and then some.
There we go.
Bye.
Okay, bye-bye. Take care. And good morning, you're on the radio.
Good morning, Jim Freund.
Good morning, how are you?
Bobson from Bulgaria. All right. Happy belated birthday to you. I'm sorry I'm almost a week late.
Thank you.
And Happy New Year as well.
Thank you. And likewise, Happy New Year.
I was thinking of being more on time with the birthday, but I was too...
I didn't feel, you know, with the death of three friends, it was one that BAI people wouldn't know, I wasn't feeling very birthday-ish last week. Otherwise, I would have done an all-music show, Steel Eye Span, and all that stuff. But I just wasn't up for it.
I missed the show last week because I was offline, and I still have to get to the...
Oh, to the archive. Well, this
archive, yes.
Yeah. Well, I talked a lot about Lynn and about Monroe and about Doctor Who. Three things that sort of go together, but not.
I think about... About the Doctor Who, the Christmas episode, I think I've seen it earlier somehow. When I watched it, it was reminded me of too much of having seen it somehow. I don't know how it happened.
Hmm, interesting. Deja Who.
Yeah. All right, well, have a great 2012, 13 and 14, etc.
Likewise, Bobson, thank you.
Good show. Thanks.
Okay, take care. Happy New Year. Bye-bye. And, yeah, that always thrills me, by the way, to have a regular caller from Bulgaria. You know, that is like, okay, that's 21st century stuff. That's cool. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hello?
Hello?
Hi there. You're on the air.
Hi. Steve from Park Slope here.
Hi.
Happy birthday and New Year. And
thank you.
Once again, we take the good with the bad, as always. In Barbara's story, Red Dybbuk, she mentions within it the play by Anski called The Dybbuk.
Right.
And this was also made into a film in 1939.
Yeah, and there was a previous film as well, silent film.
Mm-hmm.
There's actually a Dybbuk trilogy of silent films.
Mm-hmm. The one in 39 is sound.
Polish film.
Right. I just want to mention it's available on DVD, and it's absolutely enchanting to watch, and I recommend it to those among us who may be interested in that.
It's well worth watching.
Yeah.
It's a fascinating movie.
Oh, I'm glad you've seen it.
Yeah. It's of a time and a place that, had it not been made in the manner that it was, with a good, solid understanding of the history and the time and the culture from whence it came, I fear something would have been lost.
Well,
and it's also, you know, one of the few vestiges we have in its entirety of seeing something that amounts to being Yiddish theater.
Yeah, it's just a wonderful thing this was preserved, and I recommend it to people.
Yeah, we're lucky it was preserved.
Yeah, very. So, that being said...
I didn't know it was on DVD. I think I caught it on Turner Classic Movies some time back.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I found it on DVD, not too expensive either.
Good.
So, always, you know, I always enjoy the show, so have a good night.
Okay, you too. Thanks so much. Take care. And good morning, you're on the radio. Hello. Oh, dear. Okay, I recommend a good gargle rinse for that. It really, you know, because after that you hurt your throat so much. And by the way, that particular person hurting your throat may it really hurt. Anyway. Our phone number here at WBAI, you like that, Lister, is 212-209-2900 if you'd like to discuss Subversion or WBAI or that Red Dybbuk by Barbara Krasnov.
Is that Rick Santerium will call up?
No, because nothing can get to him in that kind of a manner. It's not really, you know... Not his forte. Yeah. Have you ever Googled his name and seen what you get for a definition? It's well worth doing that. Just his last name, Santorum. Yeah. It's a rather interesting result if you put that into Google. I heartily recommend it to all happy lefties for a giggle. It's a good thing. 212-209-2900. Good morning. You're on the radio. Hello.
Hey, Jim.
Hi.
How are you, man? This is George Darrow. Just checking in on you, man.
How are you?
I'm good.
I've seen you on Facebook.
Have you? Oh, yeah.
But haven't spoken to you in, oh.
Since Abby's birthday, probably, or... No, since we were hanging out in the studio with Fred.
Yeah, with Fred Kuhn a long, long time ago. Your father and then you owned the toy shop around the corner from BAI, from the church on 62nd Street.
Fun antiques.
Oh, that was a wonderful place.
Thank you very much, yeah. Daddy, Chick Darrow.
Yeah, so how are you doing?
I'm good. I'm literally... lucky enough to look at the moon right now.
Uh-huh.
And you said, you know, something about... Well, I don't want to use the same word, but I would say transformation, transmutation, transubstantiation, trans-truthification.
Mm-hmm.
Something about clarifying reality as we know it today. Like, I've been thinking about this. Like, America is like, you know, our place, our country. And the earth is our earth. So, you know, I think we have to start looking, taking the aerial view, you know, at the earth. I mean, if no one has, I mean, that might sound pedantic.
Well, that's one of the things that hopefully science fiction is supposed to do.
Quite. It does. It has.
You know, lets you take, a step away from the Earth so that you can see it better.
You don't know what you got till it's gone kind of concept, eh?
Well, no, not that. It's not that, but it's the alien viewpoint. It's the ability to look in, not in a mirror so much, but just to see the way things actually are. Forest for the trees is another way of looking at it.
Yeah, I guess I was writing a different story right there.
Yeah.
I was saying, we as a people are divided against each other. Through nations and politicals and religios and all of these things that separate the whole sphere of living that we're sitting on, spinning it, in gravity. And we hate each other for stupid ass reasons because of this illusion of what wealth is.
Yeah.
You know? What the hell is wealth? Can you drink gold? Bullion? Gold bullion? Can you, you can make sexual tools, probably.
You can make bullion soup. Just a thought.
Yeah, and I wanted to also correct some of the callers that call every show and really are really wasting a beautiful We the People's airwaves. If they would just have a little more respect and do a little less on-the-air psychoanalysis. You know what I mean? Let them hire somebody else and let the AI be, Station USA. You know, Station Earth.
There you go.
You know what I mean? Jimmy, indeed. Man, I'll be in touch, yeah?
Okay, good.
But everybody should read the Declaration of Independence.
There we go.
You know why? There's one line in there that is very tantamount to the crux of the matter here. It says we have a right to address the government, and if the government doesn't address us and just uses us or does whatever it's supposed to be in despotism, then we have actually a right and maybe even a duty to abolish that government to start another one. You know what I'm saying? It's not like we need a revolution. We just have to follow our instructions.
That's
follow the directions.
That's very Jeffersonian, actually.
Yeah, quite. I know. Jefferson is one of my heroes.
Yeah, not one of mine, I'm afraid.
Well,
he had a lot of good ideas, but he didn't practice them.
Look, he was changing the earth, man. He was changing the face of earth. And it was a hard job back in 1750.
Well, let's put it this way. He talked a good talk.
No, wait, hold on. Let me call you on that. Ready?
Yeah.
He was governor of Virginia. And he was governor of fracking Virginia.
I don't know that he was.
He did something. He tried to end slavery.
Actually, he kept slaves.
No,
he didn't.
And he didn't
stick to the part of the Declaration of Independence that called for the end of slavery. In fact, he failed slavery in many ways.
Years before that, let me explain. Country living back then, he had slaves he inherited from his father. Now, just hold it right there. He tried to end slavery when he was governor of Virginia, And the government of Virginia downplayed him for, you know, economic reasons. And then he tried to put end slavery when he wrote the Declaration of Independence. And he was edited out of that, too. But listen, everybody faults Jefferson. Jefferson did not invent slavery. And yes, everybody...
No, he didn't invent it, but he was a participant in it. He did not free his own slaves, which he promised to do, and he went back on that promise.
Jim, you have to see...
I'm sorry, I read books by people who were not fans of Thomas Jefferson. For example, a gentleman by the name of John Adams.
Well,
and Benjamin Franklin. These were Jefferson's contemporaries, and they weren't thrilled with the things that he was doing along these lines.
Well,
these were the Northerners versus the Southerners, the Federalists versus the states' rights. And Jefferson was all about states' rights, which today we call the right wing. And that's who he was.
I know what you're saying. But you have to clarify it and look, like, take the aerial view of Jefferson. And now, listen, he did not invent slavery. And literally...
What does that mean? I don't care that he didn't invent
it.
He was a practitioner of it.
I'm going to tell you what it means. I'm going to tell you right now.
He had a choice to keep slaves or not, and he kept them.
Everyone who was in power had a gigantic plantation, and they grew food, and they did stuff. And there was no, and they had to shoe horses, and they had to fix wheels, and they had to grow food, and there was no way to live without that plantation going. And he inherited all of those slaves from his family, from his daddy. So it's not like he, you know, and he gave.
It's not that
slaves,
simple, George. You're a little.
I read his writings, my friend.
Yes, he was very good to himself. Now read the writings of his contemporaries who were his critics, and you'll get...
Whoa.
I think it's fair to say read his writings, but also read the writings of his contemporaries.
I do.
His political enemies.
I do. But don't obfuscate what I'm
saying. He was one of the worst political enemies a person could have. He did more dirty tricks...
And how's Karl Rove doing?
Exactly. If you want to equate the two of them, that's okay by me.
No, I don't.
Well, I do. I do. And that's the point.
I know, but...
Don't whitewash Jefferson. He did a lot of great things. He did a lot of horrible things.
But let's see the things he created.
He was one of many, many people. He took a lot of credit. George, he took a lot of credit for what a lot of other people did.
I hear you. But look, he's still part of my mythology, and I want to just do it like a painting.
Yeah,
and
let me recommend a book called 1776 by David McCulloch, who's read it.
I have one of his other books.
Read it.
I will check that out, but just let me say the last sentence.
Yeah.
Thank you for having this Jeffersonian diet. You know, that's good. It's good because you know what? We need to do that about John Locke. We need to do that about Washington. We need to do that about every one of our Betsy Ross and all that. But what I'm saying is, in the Declaration of Independence, a stroke of genius was he wrote right into the instructions on how to make this country that if we don't like the government, we abolish it and make a new one. And I think we're of a mind now that the Tea Party and the We Party can get together and be party, the Americans who we were born to be, and stop the chicanery, and that's simple as that. And the striations of society will vanish, in my opinion.
Very good.
Okay, and I thank Thomas Jefferson for that concept.
There you go.
Amen.
Have a great morning. Okay. Take care, George. And one more call, if we can. Good morning, you're on the radio. Oh, no, you're not. You're a dial tone, so you won't be on the radio. Well, okay. Let's see. Next week on this program, Altered Fluid. That is the name of a group of writers, writer's workshop, but what we generally call writer's group. They get together, in the case of Altered Fluid, weekly. They are hard workers, every one of them. Many of them, at this point, well-established writers to be reckoned with. N.K. Jemisin, Nora Jemisin, and Lia Don Johnson, Tempest Bradford, many people. And you'll Rick Bowes, you will hear from them next week. Some of them will be here live. Devin Poor will read a short story, and then on recording, each member of that group, on recording, because I recorded it when they did it, it was in real time, will critique the short story that Devin wrote about 3.5 months ago. And then we will hear Devin, how he changed the story and all that. So it'll be a lot of fun. Devin will be here and a few members of the group, but you'll hear them all on recording. And then the week after that, we will celebrate the 40th anniversary of this radio program, Hour of the Wolf. We don't know the exact date, but we do know that it's accurate within a month or so. So I'm declaring it this time, January 18th, we'll celebrate the 40th anniversary of Hour of the Wolf, and the host for the program will be Margot Adler, who created the show. And then on January 25th, Delia Sherman and or, not and or Mike Cole, it's M-Y-K-E Cole, I'm double booked, but we will work it out. And, well, I'll let you all know soon. Visit the website, ourwolf.com, HOURWOLF. Yes, I know it's very old looking and all that, but it's relatively up to date. I am working also on creating an alternate presence at ourwolf.org, which will include a podcast. Regular podcast rebroadcasting the main parts of the show, the copyright-free parts of the show, that is to say. In other words, can't play the music. But you can always find out what's going on with the reading series, with this radio program, and various things at ourwolf.com. That's H-O-U-R-W-O-L-F. And if you care to write me, I am Jim at ourwolf.com. That's a good way of reaching me. Otherwise, one can always send mail to Jim Freund, F-R-E-U-N-D, at 120 Wall Street, New York, New York, 10005. Stay tuned for Burn Baby Burn Clappers with Lister, coming your way over these same airwaves in just a few moments. Thank you for listening, and have a happy new year.
Mm-hmm. said I am a proletarian. I am
the best. The red, white, and blue spit on you.
Mic check, it's 3 o'clock, bird, baby, bird.
Red, white, and blue, I'm not Captain America. Too black, too strong, causing mass hysteria. Trying to reach my freedom of speech and expressing myself, torching the symbol of oppression. Let that be a lesson to those that want suppression of the truth. Put on hold, the bold lose control, so they force obedience. Have you pledge allegiance to a piece of cloth? That's off the way I see it. Well, I'm going off berserk, cause the system works to jerk. My people, the people, all around the pig lurk. Tell me I'm wrong, though, that's my right, and it's right in the Constitution. Yo, that's illusion, huh? Suckers trying to change and rearrange. They say that I'm free, but they sure have a strange way of showing it. But I'm blowing the cover, the red, white, the blue, but the black for the brother. And I'm the lover of this flag, like many others take the same turn, like me, they yearn for the flag too.
The flag, I'm only doing what you told me. You don't like it, so what? I'm not scared of you. Your flag, the
See, I made up this new rule and I want y'all to learn it. Strike a match to the American flag and burn.
I don't want to be a president. That's not my business. I don't want to rule or conquer anyone. I'd like to help everyone.
I'd assist them.
Jew, Gentile, black man, white. We all want to help one another. Human beings are like real liberation. We want to live by each other's happiness, not by each other's misery.
Could we
don't want to
we
hate
really,
and despise one another.
Could we really,
this world
could
is room for everyone.
Could
the good
we
earth
really,
is rich.
Could we,
a capital
really
vibe for everyone. The way of life can be free and beautiful. But we have lost the way. Greed has poisoned men's souls. Has barricaded the world with hate. Goose-stepped us into misery and bloodshed. We have developed speed. We have shut ourselves in. Machinery that gives abundance has left us in want. Our knowledge has made us cynical. Our cleverness hard and unkind. We think too much, feel too little. More than machinery, we need humanity. More than cleverness, we need kindness and gentleness. Without these qualities, life will be violent. All will be lost. The aeroplane and the radio have brought us closer together. The very nature of these inventions cries out for the goodness of men. Cries out for universal brotherhood, for the unity of us all. Even now, my voice is reaching millions throughout the world. Millions of despairing men, women, and little children. Victims of a system that makes men torture and imprison innocent people. To those who can hear me, I say, do not despair. The misery that is now upon us is but the passing of greed, and the bitterness of men who fear the way of human progress. The hate of men will pass, and dictators die, and the power they took from the people will return to the people. And so long as men die, liberty will never perish. Soldiers, don't give yourselves to brutes. Men who despise you, enslave you, who regiment your lives, tell you what to do, what to think, and what to feel, who drill you, diet you, treat you like cattle, use you as cannon fodder. Don't give yourselves to these unnatural men, machine men with machine minds and machine hearts. You are not machines. You are not cattle. You are men. You have the love of humanity in your hearts. You don't hate, only the unloved hate, the unloved and the unnatural. Soldiers, don't fight for slavery, fight for liberty. In the 17th chapter of St. Luke it is written, the kingdom of God is within man, not one man nor a group of men, but in all men, in you. You, the people, have the power to create machines, the power to create happiness. You, the people, have the power to make this life free and beautiful, to make this life a wonderful adventure. Then in the name of democracy, let us use that power, let us all unite. Let us fight for a new world, a decent world, that will give men a chance to work, that will give youth a future and old age a security. By the promise of these things, brutes have risen to power, but they lie. They do not fulfill their promise. They never will. Dictators free themselves, but they enslave the people. Now let us fight to fulfill that promise. Let us fight to free the world, to do away with national barriers, to do away with greed, with hate and intolerance. Let us fight for a world of reason, a world where science and progress will lead to all men's happiness. Soldiers, in the name of democracy, let us all unite!
Could we really win?
Somebody say
burn, baby, burn.
Imperialist inferno.
Burn, baby, burn.
I heard somebody say
burn.